Welcome to the Neos Cosmos podcast, The Interview. I'm Ariana Alapidis. For years now, many Greek citizens have seen and continue to feel the impact of the Greek economic crisis. Someone who at one point was in the eye of one of Greece's greatest financial storms is former finance minister of Greece, Yannis Varoufakis. Ahead of his appearance at Antidote, the Sydney Opera House's Festival of Ideas and Change, the former finance minister joins us to discuss the past, the present, and the future of the Greek economic situation. Mr. Varoufakis, thank you for joining us today. I want to start off with something that was almost more of a legend back in June of 2015, when things really heated up and Greece had voted the resounding no, and obviously things took a turn from there and the banks had to close. The legend goes that you had gone home and told your Panathinai the famous words, "Honey, I closed the banks." Was that true? Did that really happen? What had really unfolded that day when you had returned home?
Isn't it interesting that your opening question should contain a toxic lie? This is how, you know, the media work these days. This is not a criticism of your medium, but it's remarkable. This is a story that was spun by a journalist, and I have completely refuted it. But, you know, this is exactly what happens when a small country like Greece goes bankrupt, and that bankruptcy is wholly inconvenient to the financiers around the world, both private financiers and public financiers, who actually created the great financial crisis. They precipitated a gigantic loss of incomes and jobs around the world. And they just don't like being told inconvenient truths. And then they start the process of demonizing those who, even very briefly, pose problems for them internationally. You see, the reason why you heard that lie about me is, firstly, the banks did not have to close. Yeah. The banks were shut by the European Central Bank in a blatant attempt to blackmail a proud people, the Greeks, into taking another credit card to pretend that we were not bankrupt when we were, because that would be convenient for the financiers. So it is a tale of David against the Goliath, where David loses because our side was disunited. This is the story of the Greeks, isn't it?
Course,
I mean, we put up fantastic fights and then we lose because we're not united amongst ourselves. But yeah, nevertheless, these were very proud moments. And the fact that the global media had tried to sully that fantastic 62%, this very courageous Greek people, by, you know, lying about what I said to my wife, as if I had said to my wife when I came in, "Honey, you know, I shrunk the kids," or I shut the banks. No, I never said that. It's remarkable that this is what sticks. You know, 6 years after the event, yeah, it's the top lie of those who damaged the whole of humanity, because this is what they did. You know, the GFC is still with us. We're now talking about the pandemic and the way in which unemployment is hitting everyone across the world. This is the same crisis due to the same interests, and they still stick to the lies that cover up for their crimes.
Having, you know, come 6 years after now, having been in that position as the finance minister back then, how do you think your actions in that position have impacted Greece today?
I'm afraid not at all. I wish that they had impacted Greece today. Look, 2015, the first 6 months, was a remarkable opportunity that we had to say no to the continuation of a lie that is very costly to the Greeks, and very costly to the rest of the world. What is that lie? You don't need to be a financier, an economist, a scientist to understand. In 2010, following the GFC, as we call it in Australia, all the banks of the world went bankrupt. And the government stepped in with a socialist plan for the bankers, bailing them out in America, in Britain, in the EU, in Australia, everywhere. They just bailed them out using, effectively, they transferred their losses onto the shoulders of the living people everywhere. And Greece happened to be, just like, you know, I don't know, you know, too young to know or to remember, but the Cold War began in Greece. Similarly, the GFC, ground zero, was Greece. For some reason, our little country attracts these global disasters for reasons we're not going to get into it now. And the way to cover up the mess was to, in 2010, to give a huge credit card, the largest credit card in the history of humanity, to the most bankrupt state, Greece. What happens when you give a credit card to a bankrupt entity? You run out of money very soon, and then you need a second credit card to pretend that you're repaying the first one. And then a third one, and then a fourth one, right? This simply makes things worse. So in the first 6 months of 2015, the Greek people elected me to be the finance minister that says, no more credit cards. We're not going to take another one. You want, yeah, let's go bankrupt. Let's embrace our bankruptcy, you know, be honest about it. Wipe out a debt that can never be repaid and will never be repaid. It's not a question of whether we want to repay, it will never be repaid. And stop the toxic austerity, the huge taxes, small businesses, and so on, that ensure this place is never going to recover. So we had this opportunity. I made headlines because I was there, you know, for them, it was unheard of. The finance minister who says no to credit card. My goodness, how can this possibly happen? So that's why you've heard of it. What was the impact in the end? Zero. Because my prime minister, Alexis Tsipras, in the end, succumbed. I resigned. He took the credit card and we continued along the way. So, you know, it was a lost opportunity. That was what my 6 months in office was.
Do you think had you pushed harder at the time, obviously there were, in previous interviews, it said that there were perhaps some other members within the party that had already made up their mind and were hoping for a yes at the time. Do you feel like if you had pushed harder for them to perhaps take on some of the solutions that you had proposed, or, you know, the next, you know, couple of actions that you had proposed, that they may have given in to you rather than to the Eurozone?
I have already made that point, done my mea culpa, acknowledged an error on my behalf. It was 6 weeks after being elected. I had an opportunity to press the button, and then things would have come to a head and there would be no more lies, one way or the other. That would be better. Whatever outcome we had would be better than what we have, in my estimation. Right? At the time, I didn't know that which I now know, that we were not united. I made the mistake of thinking that, you see, by showing good faith to the creditors, to the International Monetary Fund, to the European Union, you know, to the powers that be, I tried very hard to do the moderate thing, which is to secure a four-month period of peace and quiet so we can actually negotiate with them to establish whether there is any ground for compromise, for an honorable compromise that would be mutually beneficial, mutually advantageous. And I thought that these 4 months would be a good period during which to learn the ropes in government, to get organized, for to show good faith to the creditors, for the creditors maybe to show good faith to us. What I had not factored in was that those 4 months would not be used by our government to prepare, but they would be used by my prime minister to capitulate.
Right. If we sort of take a turn now, obviously you've got your most recent novel, Another Now, which is, you know, a very sci-fi narrative on that really delves into, you know, these alternative financial systems, which is, you know, what you'll also be delving into at the Antidote Festival. One of your characters, Costa, asks what it means to be a proletarian, and he says it means you're a cog in a process of production that relies on what you do and think while excluding you from being anything but its product. It means the end of sovereignty, the conversion of all experiential value into exchange value, the final defeat of autonomy. Do you think as a whole that the government relies on its citizens on being politically and economically illiterate to really enact these austere measures at the end of the day?
Well, what you just described, or what Costa explained as modern proletarization of human beings, is independent government. It's the way in which everybody's lives is becoming. If you think of it, you know, if you're very skilled, you're a you're tech savvy, and you work for Facebook or Microsoft, and you know, you're a very smart person, and you go through the processes of inventing new algorithms and new software. Nevertheless, when you work for big tech, in the end, you're being sucked dry by, you know, the system in which you find yourself in. Very, very soon, you become alienated from your work. You're part of a process that treats you like a cog in the machine. Similarly, you know, when you watch something, you know, a video on TikTok, when you go from one YouTube video to another as a consumer, as a viewer, as a member of the public, very soon you become part of a system that uses you, because you're creating value for those companies. You know, every time you walk around Sydney or Melbourne with your phone, when I walk around, you know, we are adding to the capital of Google. You realize that, because the machine knows where you are, so it adds information to Google Maps, and that makes Google Maps more useful to others. So it adds to the capital stock, and yet you are not part of this value creation. You don't benefit from it personally. You don't even realize it. So what Costa, my character Costa in Another Now, my novel, is doing is he's describing a process of where we are being alienated from what it is that we do. And that's not related to governments. Governments are also alienated. I mean, I've been in government for a very short period of time, but I can tell you that most politicians don't really know what they're up to. Most politicians don't even control what they're up to. You know, you all go into the ministry, you have a big pile of stuff that you have to go through. How many ministers in the Australian government, in the American government, are in control of their agenda? Talk to them, they'll tell you that they're not. They feel that they are also cogs in a machine. So in the end, you know, what is it all about? You know, what is our society about? Is it? It's clearly not about allowing us to grow and to develop as human beings, which it should be. In the end, it's a bit like, you know, The Matrix, the movie, for those who remember that old flick. Old for you, not for me. I'm too old for The Matrix to be classified as old. I still remember it when it came out. But in the end, you know, the machines that we created end up using us as power sources for them. And, you know, this is not a very clever way of running humanity. Firstly, we're destroying the planet. And secondly, we become slaves to the machines that we're supposed to be, our mechanical slaves. And government is enslaved to the corporate interests, big tech, big finance, and so on. But even those who are in big finance, who make lots of money, right? They're not happy people. They're not free people. They're also cogs in the machine. So, you know, I wrote a novel about, you know, trying to answer the very difficult question, a question that I've been avoiding all my life. How could things be different? Could we organize life, the economy, corporations, money, land, you know, housing? Could we organize things differently, given our constraints? I'm not creating science for, you know, a Star Trek world in which we have replicators producing stuff for us. No. Given the existing technologies that we have, given the fallacies of human beings, you know, our frailties and our demerits, could things be different? So that's Another Now, that I'm using science fiction in order to tell a very real story about how things are and how things might have been.
Yeah. In the when you talk about, you know, the government's also having no real control to these bigger entities, corporate entities for that matter, tech entities, financial entities, where do you think Greece falls as a cog? Who is it turning for ultimately at the end of the day? Is it a particular financial group? Is it a corporation? Who is it at the end of the day, or rather what?
Look, we are all proud to be to be Greek. We have a very long history. We love our country, this small part of the world, of the Mediterranean. We've survived 1,000 years. Different kinds of slavery, of subjugation to the Ottoman Empire, to the Roman Empire, to the British, to, you know, all sorts of different empires and powers. But let's be honest with one another. Greece is a debt colony. This place is completely and totally bankrupt, whatever the government tells you. We have a bankrupt state, we have bankrupt banks, we have bankrupt companies, and we have a bankrupt population. Everybody owes to everyone else, and no one can pay. That's the reality. We are a debt colony, and the powers that be internationally, come here. They don't even need to send the army anymore. The Germans don't need to send the Panzers and the Wehrmacht. They send the Troika, they send the EU officials, and they say, okay, these airports, we like them, we'll take them. And they take them. They just take them. They use your own money to buy the airports. Well, Santorini, everybody has heard of Santorini, Mykonos airports, these are very lucrative enterprises, right? They used to belong to the state. A German company came, and I don't know whether you know that, they paid 1.2 billion euros to buy 14 airports. But do you know who gave them that money? The Greek banks. But the Greek banks didn't have the money. So who gave the money to the Greek banks? The Greek people. Where did they get the money? The Greek people are bankrupt. They borrowed the money from the national financiers to give to the German company that put not one penny of its own money in there, right? To take, the goose that lays the golden egg, Mykonos Airport. So now they have it. It's theirs. It was always profitable, even when it was badly run by the Greek state, but it was still profitable, right? Now, that is not a sovereign country. That is not a country that fits into any business model. We don't need a very sophisticated analysis about the state of our country. It's a debt colony. The British treated India under the Raj far more nicely and politely and humanely than, Brussels and Frankfurt and Berlin are doing these days in Greece. So this is why, I'm still in politics. We have a political party. We are in parliament. It's called Mera 25. And we're fighting for liberation, for national sovereignty.
Yeah.
And we're Europeans. So we want to be in Europe, but we want to be sovereign in Europe. We do not want to be a debt colony.
Of course. And that's the thing. I think many people, or many Greeks across the world of the diaspora hoping for something better every time, every time someone comes back to the motherland, I suppose, we see what's going on and it's hard to continue witnessing what's been unfolding over the years as well. If we look at one of your other characters, Iris, she's quite the firecracker in the book. You describe her as a revolutionary, but a lone wolf rather. Rather than a believer of solidarity. Is this perhaps also the case with you? Are you like Iris, this constructed contradiction?
When you write a novel, I've never written a novel before. This is my first attempt, so I'm not an expert on writing novels, but I suspect that when anybody writes a novel, not just me, you're creating different characters and you're putting part of yourself in each one of them. But you also take parts of other people that are not yourself and you embed them in those characters, because that's a way to have a conversation with yourself while writing a novel, but not sound crazy, because if you have a conversation with yourself, people will lock you up in a lunatic asylum. But if you have characters, Costa, Iris, Eva, and Thomas, and so on, right? And they have a conversation with each other, and there are bits of you in each one of them. Then there can be an interesting conversation where I use that novel in order to, I constructed those characters and put different views that I think are valid in my head, which I have not sorted out yet. Yeah, I disagree with myself about things, and I think every thinking person should be open-minded, which is what it means. To be open-minded must mean that, you doubt yourself, you disagree with yourself. So I put these different views in the heads and hearts of these people, and I let them fight it out amongst themselves, having, these dialogues amongst themselves and, different opinions. And what was remarkable, Mariana, was that, and that's why I enjoyed writing this book so much. After a while, I was writing but I didn't feel that I was writing the book. The characters were writing themselves. And it was as if at some point, and that was a sublime moment. It felt as if I was actually eavesdropping into their conversations from which I learned. So that's why I really loved writing this book. And and finishing it and seeing it published was satisfying, but also it was a sense of loss as well that befell me.
Yeah,
I lost all my friends, and I'm not listening to them anymore.
You know, I, you know, going back to obviously, like you said, you've injected parts of yourself into certain parts of the book, and I'm assuming, you know, coming from a writer's perspective, you know, a lot of the time people say write what you know. And Iris has a very interesting point that she makes when she goes, the moment that our comrades get a whiff of power, they'll sacrifice every principle they've ever had. And those of us who remain dissidents will be demonized. You know, looking back at your time and your experiences, is this perhaps something that happened with Syriza? Did you feel demonized at the time? And when things took a turn, you know,
Of course, but this, it's not just that period.
Right.
Look, I am a left-winger, okay? I'm not hiding that. As a left-winger, however, I am acutely aware of the crimes against humanity perpetrated by the left. And those crimes against humanity began with crimes committed by leftists against leftists. Remember the Gulag in the Soviet Union, and Stalin created for communists, initially for his own comrades. Iris, a part of Iris, conveys this feeling of guilt of a leftist over the left's violation of its own principles. And, you know, we leftists must, especially those of us who are active in politics, so as not to be dangerous, we must remain always aware of our own palaces, how easy it is in order to, in the context of a liberation narrative, you know, to liberate people, whether we are, you know, talking about workers or women as feminists and so on, how easy it is when our narrative is successful and people start following us. You know, that gives us power. How easy it is to abuse that power and turn it against comrades, turn it against one another. And, you know, Iris plays that role in my book as a clarion call, as a cautionary tale for rebels, because revolutions have a tendency to eat up their own children, as we know.
Yeah. In terms of a more personal note and looking at, you know, this camaradership that once was and perhaps fell apart back then, if you don't mind me asking, what is your relationship like with Alexis Tsipras these days?
We don't have one. It's really very simple. We got together in the context of a common cause. He abandoned that cause. And it's not a personal animosity at all. But you, at a completely human level, I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question. Let's say we were here having a coffee. What would we talk about? It's impossible to have a conversation because he knows that I know that he knows. So he, you know, he cannot confess to me what he did, because then he will have a problem going about his business on a daily basis, right? Yeah. But at the same time, we're going to talk about the weather. It's boring, because we know that we know that we know. You know what I mean?
Understand? Yeah. If we, obviously you've got very strong connections with Australia, having studied here. You know, your daughter. I'm assuming he's still here.
Studied in Australia. I have not studied.
No,
I
taught him. You taught here. Sorry, my apologies. is your daughter still here as well, isn't she?
My daughter is a true blue Aussie. She's a Sydney sider. She's a true Sydney sider.
Lovely. You know, obviously, having that connection with here, there's been a lot of back and forth about the Greek vote, the diaspora's vote. And how that will affect the government in Greece. You know, it was said that you were in favour of it, but recently when the legislation came out, your party had voted against it. Why was that, and where do you stand now?
It was a terrible piece of legislation. Look, talk to your parents. Talk to your grandparents. I suspect your grandparents came to Australia, right? Or your parents came to Australia. Talk to, you know, the older members of the Greek community in any city in Australia or town. They will tell you, quite correctly, that Greek governments have always ignored them, treated them like fodder, and when they wanted something from the Greek diaspora, you know, a minister or a member of parliament from Athens would arrive. They would come to the community hall, you know, to the Greek community center, and they'd say, oh, you know, our brothers and sisters, you're so fantastic. Help, either financially or politically or with votes. And then, of course, they forget about the Greeks in Australia yet again, immediately after that. And, you know, when we entered parliament in 2019, we had a very clear agenda of giving the vote, the right, not giving the vote, you have the right to vote. You have the right to vote. You can come to take the plane, you know, come to Greece and vote. So it's not a question of whether you should have a vote or not. You know, the Brits deny their own country, men and women, the vote after 2 years. If you leave Britain for 2 years, then you lose the right to vote. The Greek state doesn't do that. So, you know, you might have moved to Australia in 1940, but you can come back and vote anytime. But that does, yeah. So the whole point is whether we should allow our members of the diaspora to vote near their homes in Adelaide, in Perth, in Darwin. That is the question. Our position is absolutely. But MERA 25 was committed from day one, because I am Greek Australian too, right? And I always think of my daughter that, you know, if you're a Greek citizen, you should have exactly the same electoral rights as a Greek living in Kavala or Patna. That's our view. So in 2019, I had a discussion with the Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, and behind closed doors, he agreed with the proposal. The proposal that I made was in the same way that if you live in Kastoria, right, there is the Kastoria constituency, right? And you vote there for an MP, so you have the right to vote and you have the right to be elected. Mariana, in your case, I'm taking you, or my daughter, Xenia, or anyone in Sydney, in Melbourne, wherever, we should create a constituency for Australia. And if there are many Greeks who register and this constituency becomes too big, maybe break it up to have, you know, Western Australia and Eastern Australia, right? And you should have the right, as Mariana, not only to vote, but also to stand in your constituency with the possibility of being elected and coming to Athens to represent the good people of New South Wales or Victoria, right? This is our view. Our view is that same rights for the Greeks living in Greece with the Greeks living outside of Greece, which means the right to elect and to be elected, okay? So what the government tried to push through parliament is, yes, you should have the right to vote, but not the right to be elected. So effectively that's creating it, you know, it's turning you into a second class Greek citizen. If you deny, if the government and the parliament denies you rights that I have here in Greece, then you are breaking down the very sacred premise that Greeks should have the same rights. And it would be wonderful, would it not be? Imagine if, you know, during the election, you folks, I don't know whether you are in Sydney or in Melbourne, you elected a representative to sit in our parliament. Your community would be enriched. Greece, mainland Greece, would be enriched. Imagine if you were elected MP for, you know, Victoria, let's say, Greek MP for Victoria. Imagine how important it would be to have a meeting with your local Australian MP, federal government MP, as a Greek MP representing Greek Australians. Yeah, that would really, it would revive our Greek communities. Because, you know, one of the problems that we have with our Greek communities in Australia is that, take my daughter hardly ever goes to the Greek community because, you know, she's a 17-year-old brat who, you know, has her friends and doesn't. It's very difficult for our communities to maintain the link with the young. But if you say to them, look, come to the Greek community center and there's going to be a ballot box, and we're going to elect one of our own to represent us collectively as Greek Aussies to the Greek parliament. That to me is a recipe for reviving Greek Australian communities, for making them, you know, making them more viable as communities and linking them better even to the Australian political life. So this is, you know, we tabled back in August of 2019, a bill which does that. Effectively, it says that what should apply in Kastoria should apply in New South Wales. And the other parties really didn't like that at all. they want to treat you as clientele, people to vote for them. But they do not want you to be represented. And this is something that Mera 25 is not going to stand for. And that's why we voted against that. We're not going to accept that you should have fewer political rights as a Greek citizen than, you know, people here in Aegina or in Kastorian.
Understood. Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot to still be fleshed out and agreed upon, and how that would look not only in Australia but other parts of the world where Greeks have really flourished and created their communities. If we look at your time as an academic back at the University of Sydney, are you still doing work in academia, or have you left the universities behind for now?
I think I probably have. I'm an honorary professor of political economy at the University of Sydney. Before the lockdown, I would give a few lectures every year. The lockdown has changed all that. I still do stuff over the internet like we all do, like we're doing now. But I'm afraid that, you know, when I dedicate myself to something, it's full on. So when I was at the University of Sydney, I was in my office at the Merriweather building in Camperdown for 10, 12 hours a day. I can't do something half-heartedly. So now I'm in Parliament, I'm doing this full on. But, you know, you can take me out of the university, you cannot take the university out of me. So I keep, you know, nice summer holidays, and I'm going to write some article or a book maybe, which is quasi-academic. But yes, I'm out of university.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, that you've taken that step back. Obviously in the book, you're not too kind to the structure of universities. You know, you said, well, the characters have said, you know, universities are not about imparting skills. They're about producing flexible minions dying to do as they are told. You're there to manufacture young people willing, desperate to be moulded by the future boss's priorities. You know, is that... Why? Obviously, you've taken a step back because you're putting more work into the party, but is that why maybe you had taken a greater step back rather than, you know, popping in for a lecture or two?
There is an element of truth in what you're saying. But no, I mean, I would not have left university life if it was not for the fact that Greece went bankrupt and I kept saying things about what we should do. And then at some point, I was asked to be finance minister, right? So I would still be in academia if that did not happen. Let me be entirely honest with you. But having said that, look, everything I said in the book, critical of universities, is true. I believe that. I always believe it. Still, I love universities. Because you know why? Because universities give you a chance. As a student and as a professor, they give you a chance. A chance, a small opportunity, a tiny little window of hope, that you can actually do some independent thinking and some independent research and some writing. Okay? It's a chance, because let's face it, most students go in there, they do the coursework by rote, they want to get it out of the way, they want to get their degree and get a job and get a mortgage, and you know, by the time that they're 30, forget about the fact that they went to university, right? Let's be honest. But some students get something out of it. They have an opportunity. Yeah. If you go straight from high school to work, you don't get this opportunity to be in a library, to think independently, yeah, to read non-instrumentally, to read something for no reason. Do you know how fantastic that is? To read something for no reason. Yeah. You're not reading something instrumentally in order to pass your exam or to learn how to bolt together an engine. This is all important stuff. But the opportunity to read something for no reason and then suddenly to discover something in that which you read for no reason that changes your life and or makes you, you know, more creative, that is a fantastic opportunity. Doesn't mean that many people use it. Doesn't mean that anybody will use it more than once. But if you use it once in for the 4 years or 3 years you spend at university, that's time well spent. So universities usually, yes, I mean, it's as Iris says in the book, you know, that's what they do. They train you how to be, you know, a good employee, how to, you know, how to learn to meet deadlines, to appear in meetings, to, you know, to submit essays at the right moment, and to be compliant. But at the same time, they give you an opportunity to come up with heretical thinking. Because let's face it, you know, today's knowledge was a heresy a few years back. And that's how humanity progresses.
Yeah. And speaking on that, you know, that reading to read and to you know, just fill the space in your head with a bit more knowledge. Obviously, universities I've seen as places to form theory and create these ideas, you know, by yourself or amongst your peers. You know, a lot of people may say and have come out to say that they feel maybe your theories and ideas have been too outlandish, or perhaps they look really good on paper and then, you know, they read really well, but in reality they don't work. Why do you think this is? You know, have you had the chance to put any of it into practice? And if so, where did it go wrong, if that's the case?
Well, look, every time in the last 1,000 years, anybody has come up with a challenge of the status quo, with a new perspective on how things work. Whether this is me or John Maynard Keynes in 1936 with the general theory, or in science, you know, Einstein with relativity theory. Everybody thought it was outlandish. My God, this is crazy. Especially those whose salary depends on perpetuating the status quo. So, you know, those people who actually damaged humanity irreparably with the work they did in Wall Street and in the financial sector, they hate everything I've ever written. But that's it's a medal of honor that I wear it on my on myself, and I parade it around very, very proudly. I'm not going to be the judge of books I've written, like The Global Minotaur. Ask the people who've read my Global Minotaur back in 2010 whether it helped them understand the GFC. Many people say that they changed their perspective. Even those who work in the banking sector, even in Australia, some have said, "Oh yeah, you're a radical lefty, but you know, I understand now how banks work a lot better having read your book." I get a lot of that. And that is a great source of satisfaction. So, you know, the work I do now on digital cryptocurrencies for the central bank and so on, many people hate it, both those who are in favor of Bitcoin and those who are against Bitcoin and so on. But I do believe it's a serious contribution to, you know, how we understand the capacities of central banks to democratize money. So, but again, I'm not going to be the judge of it. People out there. So, you know, the fact that my book, talking to my daughter about the economy, speaking about Sydney side, the daughter, has been translated in 34 languages and has changed the perspective of many people around the world, is, you know, gives me a great deal of satisfaction, I have to confess. As for what I try to implement, remember, I was in government for 5.5 months. Okay, you need to put this in that perspective. And I try to implement one thing, only one thing, because you have 5 months in government and you manage to implement one thing, that's a great thing to implement. And the one thing I tried to implement was to give a charge card, a debit card, to poor people, 300,000 of the poorest families, so that I can put food on the table. And I did that in the first month I was in office. And, you know, it's not high theory. You give a MasterCard to poor people, go to the supermarket and put some food on the table in the middle of the humanitarian crisis. Now, you will never hear my detractors speak of that, but that's okay, because that's their job. And the one big failure I had was that I tried to stop our government from taking another credit card. I failed in this, but I'm very proud of the fact that I tried. I was the only finance minister in the history of Europe that tried to prevent its government from taking another credit card. And, you know, in that, I get a lot of kudos out of right-wingers, because this is a strange thing about my life. I get a lot of applause from liberals, even in Australia, who say, you know, this is a lefty who said no to a credit card. He must have done something right there. The fact that my prime minister, you know, took the credit card, oh, well, I'm not responsible for that.
Again, but those parts of history that are often are highlighted in very specific ways, I suppose, for the narrative to come out in a particular way for everyone, at the end of the day. When you look at where Greece is now, obviously you've got the party that you're in, but you know there's been a multitude of massive changes over the last even 20 years. When you look to the future, what do you hope? You know, what are your hopes for Greece? Where do you hope it will be in the future? You know, where would you really like to see Greece at?
Well, let me tell you what I would like to stop from happening. I would like to stop Greece becoming Hawaii. Because if you go to Hawaii, especially to the big island, what you'll find is that the native population live in the center of the island in slums. The coastal area, which is beautiful, they're all five-star hotels owned by foreigners and visited by foreigners. And the local population who live in slums are bussed into the hotels and to clean the toilets and to play Hawaiian guitars for the tourists. And then they're brought back into the slums in the center of the island at midnight. I don't want Greece to become that. It is becoming. You know, our youth are leaving. We have fantastic scientists and doctors and so on. They're going all over the world. And there's a very serious danger that this dead colony is going to become like Hawaii, our beautiful coasts. Are going to be populated by five-star hotels owned by foreigners and visited by foreigners. All folk homes where, Norwegians and Germans, overage pensioners, will be coming to spend out the rest of their days in five-star accommodation with the Greeks being cleaning the toilets for them. This is a dystopic outcome, but it is a very real one if we let things continue the way they're going. So I want to stop them. I want this place to be a place of shared prosperity for Greeks. I would like Greece to be a hub for green energy, to use the wonderful winds that we have in the Aegean, floating windmills, to power, to create renewable electricity, to create hydrogen so that we can supply the rest of the Mediterranean Europe with, clean energy. That's something that, for instance, will create a lot of technology, a lot of good quality green jobs here in Greece to retain the great youth that we have from migrating to the rest of the country. I want our state to stop being bankrupt and stop rolling over its debt and taking one credit card after the other, which it is allowed to do on condition that it turns Greece into Hawaii. So this is a great place. For me, it's the most beautiful part of the world. Okay, I'm biased. And the Greeks are a remarkable people. Yes, of course, we can be a main pain in the neck, as you know. We are, astonishingly annoying, especially to one another. But, it's a very resourceful people, very clever people, and very humane people in the end. Even the real bastards that we have around here, excuse the French, in the end, they're not serious bastards. After a while, you can find humanity in them. So we have a duty after so many thousand years of history. And I'm not saying this as a nationalist. I'm saying this as a patriot. And as a person who wants more foreigners to come to Greece and mingle with us, like we've always done. Thousands of years, we have mingled with people who came to this place and in the end became Greeks, more Greeks than the Greeks. And to make this a place where we have, green shared prosperity, to give you a political slogan, if you want.
When we, if obviously that time back then has passed us now, those 6 years ago, and when you look back at that time and when Greece had really, those capital control measures had been stamped on the country, Syriza, Alexis, Mr. Tsipras and yourself had really become the poster people for what had happened, be it true or not, in whoever's eyes. Did you ever feel any personal responsibility for the conditions that had come out, the hunger, the poverty, the the crying in the streets that had actually happened at that time?
Absolutely not. This is a disgraceful question, if I may say. Not personally, but it's a disgraceful concept even to have. And look at the statistics. Greece fell into a hole, and that's why we were elected. It didn't fall into a hole because we were elected. Remember, the Greeks did not suddenly become left-wing electors. They tried every other government first. From 2010 to 2014, before we were elected, national income fell by 28%. Can you get that? Let me remind you that when in Australia you had your last recession under Paul Keating, remember Paul Keating? What you had was a 1% reduction in national income, 1%. We had a 28% reduction. You know, we had people eating out of the garbage bins. And that was why we were elected. It's not because we were elected. So our detractors on the right that are criminally responsible for this poverty of the people would like to throw the, the blame on us, but it doesn't wash. If you look at GDP, of national income, in 2015 it stabilized. It was falling precipitously until we were elected. So no, absolutely not. We were not responsible, whether I disagree with Alexis Tsipras or not. We stabilized this. Greece has been stabilized at a very low level. But the fall came before we were in government. If you look at the support of the poor, I gave you an example. You know, the first thing I did in government was to give a MasterCard to poor families to put food on the table for the first time in years. And this is why. You know, ask yourself, Mariana, the question, why was it that 62% backed the no that I was recommending to people? In January, 6 months before, only 36% of the people had voted for us. You know, we didn't have that much of a majority. You know, we won 36% of the vote. And in those 6 months, by the referendum of the 5th of July 2015, we went from 36% to 62%. We have massive support. And this is why, if you walk with me down the street, all you'll find is that, you know, people are expressing exactly the opposite sentiment from that embedded in your question.
Lovely. Mr. Varoufakis, I want to thank you for joining Neos Cosmos' podcast, The Interview, today. Listeners can find more of our exclusive interviews by visiting www.neoscosmos.com.
Well, thank you very much. And my greetings to all my friends in Australia, and I've got a lot of them, and to my enemies.